Okay, so it's wonderful to be back with you to learn about some of our early Zionist friends. And just a reminder that we'll pick up next week at the same time. Next week is, I think, at least from my perspective, my favorite unit of this section, with one possible exception. But we're going to be learning next week about Herzl. So always a pleasure to think about and learn about Herzl. So please join us next week. But before we do, I want to turn our attention this week to a man called Rabbi Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer. Okay, and you could think of him sort of in parallel to Rabbi Yehuda Alkalai, who we studied last week. And in a lot of ways, Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer might be described as kind of the Ashkenazic equivalent of Rabbi Yehuda Alkalai. Sadly, they didn't know about each other until late in their lives. There's something sort of fascinating about looking at them and thinking about them comparatively and noticing that they arrived at so many of the same ideas in different geographic and cultural settings. One is in Zemun in like Serbia, and the other is like just smack in the middle of then Prussia, now Poland. And somehow they're absorbing a lot of the same notions about nationalism and about self-determination that we'll speak more about in just a moment. And at some point, they did find each other. Okay, so who is Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer? So let's talk a little bit about his biography, and then we'll look a little more in depth at his work, at his philosophy and his legacy, what he contributed to the Zionist idea. So Kalischer was born in Lissa, in the Prussian province of Posen, which is now Leszno in Poland. He was always destined for the rabbinate, and he was educated by two very, very prominent Gedolei Israel. One was Rabbi Akiva Eiger, whom we've all heard of, and the second was a man whose name is a little less well known to us, but in the Beis Medrash, everybody studies his sefer, the Baal HaNesivos, Rav Yaakov of Lissa. So the Ketzos HaChoshen is one of the most important books of Lamdus in the Beis Medrash for anyone doing serious learning. And the Nesivos is the one who takes on the Ketzos and they duke it out, and you could get into like the depths of Pilpul when you learn the Ketzos and the Nesivos. So the author of the Nesivos is this Rabbi Rav Yaakov of Lissa. And he was the teacher of Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer. I'll just put in for in a parenthesis that Rabbi Yaakov of Lissa was also the great grandson of the Chacham Tzvi. So it always comes back to the Chacham Tzvi. So he was the teacher of Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer. And after a marriage in Lissa, he settled in the town of Thorn, Thorn. It's a city on the Vistula River, which was then in Prussia. And now I think the town is spelled Torun in northern Poland. That's where Copernicus lived, obviously not in the same in the same century. And that is where Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer spent the rest of his life. Okay, so I'll just put on the screen, and you have it in your source sheet. That's one of the only photos that we have very late in life of Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer. And here's a map just so you could situate yourself. Okay, so this is present day. This is present day Poland. And you could sort of see we're in between Poznan and Warsaw, a little north of Warsaw, and obviously way west of Bialystok. Decidedly in Ashkenaz. So he becomes the rabbi of this very small community. There's probably a few hundred Jews. I don't think we have the exact numbers, but it's a shtetl, a few hundred Jews living in this city, in this city called Torn. Okay, he never took a salary. To the extent that he ever earned any money or people made gifts or tried to sponsor him, So he always donated it to whatever cause was supporting Palestine. We weren't calling it Zionism. It's a little anachronistic to call it Zionism in this moment. But retrospectively, it was the pre-Zionist cause. So it's not really clear to me. And one source, something about his being independently wealthy. And another source, his wife ran a small business and supported him. Either way you slice it, he was taken up with his rabbinic responsibilities, and later with his pro and proto-Zionist responsibilities, without ever really having to worry about how to make ends meet. Okay, as we talked about last week with respect to Yehuda Alkali, the influence of nationalism was all around. Again, so you look at the 19th century map, so who's vying for their national independence and autonomy? So it's the Italians and the Greeks and the Hungarians and the Poles. So, everyone is putting forward this notion that we can be our own independent people. And again, there's a conversation to be had around the question of what constitutes a people. Is it geography? Is it language? Is it culture? Is it heritage? Is it history? We'll return to that a little more next week. But, certainly geography is playing a role for all these nations. We're not just, Venetians, we're Italian. And there's a sense of nationhood and nationalism, which is brewing all around. So as early as 1836, okay, Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer was born in 1795, so he's a man in his early 40s. As early as 1836, he was dreaming of a return to Zion. Okay, and he actually wrote to a man who was one of the wealthiest and most prominent Jews of his day, Asher Anshel Rothschild, suggesting that he buy Jerusalem from Muhammad Ali. Okay, Muhammad Ali, not the boxer. I mention it just because it reminds us a little, and we'll talk about Herzl next week, it reminds us a little of kind of the brazenness and the kind of chutzpah that one could suggest that we could just kind of flip a switch and make something happen that would precipitate a mass movement from Europe or from the Ottoman Empire to Palestine. We have no record of Rothschild ever even answering this correspondence. But again, you could sort of see the seeds being planted. We're going to need big, bold ideas. And a lot of people are going to say no. Eventually, somebody's going to say yes. And we'll move the needle one step at a time. Okay, I'll also say a little parenthetically that in the 21st century, we're less sensitive to this because there's not a battle, there's not a current battle between denominations or among denominations in our community. So on our block, there's the Orthodox shul, on the next block, there's a Reform shul, and it doesn't bother anyone. We're not fighting with them. They have their community and we have our community, and they'll do some things themselves and we'll do some things ourselves, and sometimes we'll get together. So in 19th century, there were battle lines, okay? And everyone was engaged in this battle for the soul and the future of the Jewish people. And everyone is recruiting, and everyone is trying to figure out a path forward. So this is the age of emancipation and enlightenment, and reform says, we don't need to be held back by the yoke of obligation and mitzvos and Torah. We can acculturate and we can be modern citizens of the world, and we'll also be Jewish, with some Jewish identification. And obviously the Orthodox and the traditionalists are fighting tooth and nail to retain the traditions of the past. Okay, so by definition, if you're a traditionalist, you're anti-reform, and vice versa. So I'll just point out as a kind of a sidebar, but it has important resonances for the next, let's say, 100 years, thinking about, the 1830s, 1840s. So Kalischer was not just against the Reform Jewish movement because he was a traditionalist, but he saw reform as a movement which was, by definition, almost anti Zionist, and again, he wasn't using that term, but was opposed to the notion that Jews should ever have any interest in returning to Palestine. Okay, I'll just share with you one excerpt from something he wrote. I didn't put this on the source sheet, but he said, what the children of Israel were saying to Moses on the eve of the deliverance at the Red Sea was that at that stage, it would be far better for them to be free men in Egypt. What did they need another country for? Right, all the Sefer Bamidbar, it's, you know, the Israelites always saying to Moshe, why'd you take us out? We would have been better off in Mitzrayim. Today too, Kalischer writes, today too, when Jews obtain equal rights in the exile, they no longer contemplate going to Eretz Yisrael. On the contrary, there's a stigma attached to the ideas. They say, here is Eretz Yisrael. They do not perceive the works of the Lord and the power of his holiness, which will be made manifest in the Holy Land. And there's much more to say about this, but it was one of the most prominent planks of the Reform platform, the sense that, you know, fill in the blank, Berlin is the new Jerusalem, Pittsburgh is the new Jerusalem, you know, whatever decade we're talking about. So they excised from the liturgy all mention of Korbanos and a return to Zion and a rebuilding of Jerusalem. Those are all gone. Okay, it wasn't until the 1950s that Reform Jews finally turned the corner and said, you know what, maybe Zionism isn't such a bad idea after all. Okay, so it's just fascinating to think about and to recognize this history. And it's so almost ironic that in the 21st century, you know, Israel is one of the last things that the Reform movement holds on to, but it was actually one of the first things that it jettisoned in the 19th century. Dream of going back to Palestine? Who needs Palestine? We're at home right here. And again, as I mentioned last week, you know, Palestine was a backwater. There's just a few thousand Jews there. It's malaria infested and nobody can make a living. And, you know, who wants to be there? The weather's terrible. You can't make anything grow. There's not enough water. There's no irrigation. So, you know, this fanciful thing of returning to Zion. So the Reform said it's not just a bad idea. It's counter to everything we're going for. We're trying to move forward and to be emancipated and to be acculturated and to be absorbed into the, you know, 19th century high society. And you, Zionists, again, anachronistically, you're going backward to a land that can't be built up and is nothing to do with modernity. And like, what are you holding on to? We've already gotten there. We've arrived. Why would you want to go back? Already in the 1830s, and again, we'll circle back and amplify this in a minute, but already in the 1830s, Zvi Hirsch Kalischer began a correspondence, which became quite famous, a correspondence with the Chasam Sofer and Rabbi Akiva Eger, two of the greatest Hungarian poskim of their generation. A correspondence with the two of them about the reintroduction of Korbanos. So Zvi Hirsch Kalischer said, why don't we reinstitute Korbanos? You know what we could do? We could go back to Israel, and we'll go right up to the Temple Mount. The fact that there's no temple shouldn't stop us. We'll build a Mizbeach and we'll bring Korbanos. So we'll come back to this in a minute, but I'll just share with you a quote from Yaakov Katz, the great 20th century historian. He said that the implication of this correspondence was the possibility of a restoration of Jewish life in Israel without awaiting a miracle. So again, this wasn't a political plan. This wasn't a practical plan, but this was a conceptual religious plan that was being sort of duped out in the Beis Medrash, so to speak, you know, in a halachic correspondence and responsa literature to entertain the possibility, hey, what do you think halachically of the idea of bringing a korban in the 19th century? You know, and you can ask the same question. How about in 2022? Why not bring korbanos? What's stopping us? Okay, so again, we'll circle back to it in a second, but already you can see this sense in early in the career of Zvi Hirsch Kalischer that the wheels are spinning and the thinking is we're not waiting for Mashiach, right? We can actually take destiny into our own hands and move the Jewish future ahead on our own. And, you know, we talk and we daven about a rebuilt Jerusalem. Let's rebuild it, right? Halachically speaking, let's put up a mizbeach and we'll bring korbanos. It sounds radical. Maybe it was, but this correspondence was actually quite fascinating and remains the sort of central source for anyone interested in entertaining this question, the back and forth between Zvi Hirsch Kalischer on the one hand and the Chasam Sofer and Rabbi Kiva Eger on the other. Okay. 1860, Zvi Hirsch Kalischer holds what was functionally the first Zionist conference in the history of the world. And he gathered together whoever he could find, he invited his friends and his colleagues and other rabbis to come and talk about what it would mean to go back to Palestine. 1861, he formed something called the Society for the Colonization of Palestine. In 1862, he published his most important work called Drishat Zion. And we'll talk about that in a couple minutes, where he lays out his plan for what a return to Palestine would look like. It wasn't until 1863 that Alkali finally learned of Kalischer and vice versa, and they started to correspond with one another. In 1864, in Berlin, he founded something called the Central Committee of Societies for the Settlements of Israel. And again, there's like a pre-Herzl, proto-Herzl phenomenon here. He wrote and he traveled and he preached and he fundraised and he did whatever he could to stir up interest in this dream of returning to Zion. So basically, as a function of his agitation, the Alliance Israelite Universelle founded something called Mikveh Israel, which was the first agricultural school in Palestine in 1870, right outside, if I remember my geography correctly, right outside of Cologne. And again, we'll circle back to this next week. Herzl visited Palestine. You know how many times in his life? I'll give you a hint. It's the exact same number as the number of times that Rav Joseph B. Soloveitchik visited Palestine in his life. Once, okay? Joseph B. Soloveitchik went in 1935, still Palestine, to apply to be the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv. Didn't get the position. Herzl went once in 1898, to meet Kaiser Wilhelm. And where did he meet him? He met him in Mikveh Israel, the agricultural school founded in 1870 by none other than Zvi Hirsch Kalischer. Okay. At the very end of his life, in around 1871, the Mikveh Israel Chevra invited him and said, "Why don't you come be the Rav of our community?" He was ready to go, but by that point, his health was failing, he never made it. He actually had a whole, there was a goodbye correspondence, and he started writing to people and saying, "I'm living my dream, and I'm moving to Palestine." And people sent him gifts, and people sent him money. And he said, "I'm not taking any of your money. I'm donating it to the cause." And in the end, he never made it to Palestine. In the end of his life, he passed away in 1874. So let me just say something about the works that he contributed to posterity. So he was a massive Talmud Chacham. And sometimes this gets missed because we always think of him as a pre-Zionist, a proto-Zionist. But he wrote very learned works, which are still referenced to this day in the Beis Medrash. He wrote a book called Evan Bochan, which is a commentary on Choshen Mishpat. He wrote a book called Sefer Moznaim Mishpat, another Sefer on Choshen Mishpat, Tzvila Tzadik, on Yoredeya, Sefer HaBrit, a commentary on the Torah, Sefer Yetzias Mitzrayim, a commentary on the Haggadah. He wrote Chidushim on several Masechtos of Shas, and he contributed largely and regularly to Hebrew magazines. I always make this point. You get to the 19th century, so there's journals and there's newspapers and there's periodicals, and this becomes the language of the learned class. They're always writing articles and opinion pieces and book reviews, and then they write letters to the editor and they respond to each other, and you have these correspondences which transcend geography and cultural boundaries. So he contributed to HaMagid and Sion and HaIvri and HaLevanon, And again, all those journals, they're all digitized. They're all accessible in your living room. You could just go to the National Library of Israel homepage. You could find any article you want from the 19th century from any of these periodicals. Some of them are in Hebrew, some of them are in French, some of them are Yiddish, some of them are in German, some of them are in English. And you could find whatever you're looking for. It's really extraordinary if you have a few extra minutes to explore. Okay. So let me turn for a second to Drishat Zion. Okay, Drishat Zion, he published in 1862. It's his magnum. It's his magnum opus, and he laid it out in three parts. The first part. Let me just take you through them so we have an understanding of what we're dealing with, and what his principal contribution was to the history of Zionism. So, in part number one of Drishat Zion, Kalischer laid out his plan to create an agricultural society in Israel. And again, agriculture is very important. The notion of the Jews supporting themselves. They weren't going to get to Israel and set up a shop to sell watches. They were going to work the land and earn a living as farmers. Okay. The sense was that human efforts will help bring about a redemption. And amazing to compare this language. But remember last week, I shared with you an entire excerpt from an essay that Yehuda Alkalai wrote where he said, tshuva, it's gotten misappropriated. And the rabbis kept talking about tshuva as a notion of repentance and klapping al chait. It's what you do before Yom Kippur. That's all fine and good. But tshuva at its core really means a return to the land. And if you go back to the psukim, that's what it's all about. And Zvi Hirsch Kalischer said the same thing. Right? He said, if you want to know what tshuva is, go back to the psukim and you'll understand that tshuva is about a return to the land. Just to summarize sources one and two on your sheets. So I'll just share with you a quick excerpt, which he actually didn't write in Drishat Zion, but he captured this sentiment in Drishat Zion also. He said, "Hello, Yecheskel, Amar Beferush, it's Chila Yel Yisrael Hamoshav, Me'amim, Mikneh, Vekinyan, Vehi Me'amim, Hotza'a, Ve'achrach Yavo Gog, Umagog, Ve'achrach Yavo Mashiach." He said, first, you got to go back to the land and have a settlement and have some ownership and have some bailus over the land of Israel. And then there'll be Gog, Umagog, and then there'll be Mashiach, all the prophecies that we read about in the Nevi'im. Those will come true, but first you got to go back to the land, not the other way around. Ve'eich yavo pitom. What you think is like Mashiach's just going to fall out of the sky. It's not going to happen in a flash. It's going to happen incrementally, and we have to start the process by returning to the land. I have this for you in source number two. It says, do not think that God will suddenly send the Messiah from heaven to blow the great shofar to the scattered people of Israel and gather them to Jerusalem as promised through his servant. Certainly, all the words of the prophets will come to pass at the end of days, but not suddenly in one day. Rather, the redemption of Israel will come very slowly. The dawn of salvation will flower when Israel acts with courage and realizes all the aims and promises of the holy prophets. Step number one, return to Israel, build an agricultural society that's self-sustaining, and then we can precipitate the coming of the Messianic era. Part number two of Drishat Zion. He quoted a whole slew of Mamre Chazal about the centrality of Israel, right? So we looked at some of them last week, but the Gemara is at the end of Ksuvos that if you live outside of Israel, it's like you have no God, and you have to live in Israel, and there's only three excuses not to live in Israel. If you don't have one of those excuses, so you're living in sin. V'chule v'chule v'chule, to convince any prospective reader that Israel was the place to live and Israel was the place to be, preempting the critics, right, who asked sort of the $64,000 question, which is, if this whole logic is right and we're supposed to go back to precipitate the return rather than wait for Mashiach before we go back, why hasn't anyone argued this in the past 1800 years, right? The Rambam also knew all the sources you quoted, and Rashi also knew all the sources you quoted, and Yosef Karo also. They were smart. They knew all this material. Why didn't they ever suggest, as you, Zvi Hirsch Kalischer, are suggesting, that we return to Israel and bring the Messianic era by our own means? So preemptively, he wrote and said that in the past 1800 years, Jews had neither the means nor the influence to make this dream a reality. We're just running away from the Cossacks, right, to try to, you know, save our family. We think we have the capacity to start buying land and talking to nobles and negotiating with diplomats. We're just trying to live in exile, like literally just trying to survive. So he says in the 19th century, emancipation, enlightenment, it's a new world and there's new opportunity. How could we not take advantage? Source number three, he argues for the restoration of Korbanos, and he had collected already in the 1830s all of this correspondence between Kalischer and Rabbi Akiva Eiger and the Chasam Sofer, as I mentioned. And he publishes it and says, you know, there's arguments both ways, and here's why we could, and here's why you might object, but here's an argument in favor of why we could reestablish the institution of Korbanos in the Holy Land. Okay. I'll just share with you, because this got published not just by Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer, but in the Shuvos of the Chasam Sofer himself. Okay, and he wrote, here's the title page, by the way, to Drishat Zion, 1862. Okay, and here's the tshuva from the Chasam Sofer, picking up in the middle. So so let me just see if I can find the right spot to begin. Okay, so Rabbi Akiva Eiger had written to the Chasam Sofer, his son-in-law, and said, what about this idea of bringing back the Korbanos? It seemed like Rabbi Akiva Eiger was actually open to Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer's suggestion. And he wrote to the Chasam Sofer and says, you know, you have some connections politically. Maybe we could ask and we could make it happen. And the Chasam Sofer says, you know, you asked me, Lavakesh, Misari, Yerushalayim, Liten, Rishus, Lakriv, Hu, Kaptan, Gadol. You asked me to make this request that maybe we could get permission to bring Korbanos. He says, Kiahu Amar Lavali Krav, Sham Misha Enu Me'emunas Yishmael. Ki Sham Nibne Abes Avodah Shalahem. V'yomrim She'evin She'siya Be'emtza HaKipa Ha'hi. V'lo Yikrav Sham Ishzar She'enu Me'umanosam. He says, you know, there's one major issue with your suggestion. The major issue with your suggestion is something called the Dome of the Rock, right? Why is it called the Dome of the Rock, by the way, right? So what's the rock? So the rock is this Eben Shesia, right? The foundation stone, right? That is believed to be in that spot, right? And that's why it's holy both to the Temple Mount for us and for Muslims. So he says, it's a nice idea to go up to the Temple Mount and bring Korbanos, but I don't know if you noticed this, there's something called the mosque, the Dome of the Rock, and they're not going anywhere, and you're not allowed to go there unless you are practicing Islam, which we are not. So you could have all the ideas you want about the restitution, or the reinstitution rather, of Korbanos. No way it's going to happen as long as the Muslims are in control of the Temple Mount. Okay, so putting that aside, Rav Kalischer argued that Jews should proactively buy land in Israel. You know, his vision was that there'd be immigration from Eastern and Central Europe, and that the rest of the Jewish world should fund it by supporting those migrating Jews financially. He envisioned a formation of a militia for defense. And as we talked about already, it was his dream to establish an agricultural school, a dream that actually came true when Mikveh Israel was opened in 1870. Okay, and he also, you know, said it's not just going to be good for the Jews, but it's going to be good for everyone. I have this in source number four. He says, this will be the object of praise and glory in the eyes of the nations, who will say that the children of Israel are people with the spirit to demand and renew the inheritance of their father. If the Italians and other peoples sacrifice themselves on behalf of their ancestral homeland, how much more so a land like this, which all the world regards as holy, while we stand afar like a man who has no courage or heart. Okay, so if the Italians can rebuild Italy, and form a nation. Why can't Jews rebuild Palestine and form a nation? It wouldn't just be any land. Everyone recognizes that it would be a holy land. Why should we be any worse than the Italians or the Hungarians or the Poles or anyone else who's vying for national independence in this moment? Okay, and source number five, he echoes his sentiment, and he says, we have enough examples of how other nations give of their possessions and their blood to recover land which was long lost to them. No sacrifice was too great to achieve their purpose. How much more for us Jews, whose nation is so strongly connected to our holy religion, should we fail in comparison with other nations? Let me just say one or two more points, and then I'll pause to ask if there are any questions, and then we'll sort of turn to the legacy and afterlife of Rav Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer. So just a couple of footnotes to the kind of philosophy of Rav Kalischer. He believed that Jewish nobles, and again, he has in mind, you know, of the world, the Rothschilds and Montefiore and Fuld and Crémieux, he viewed them as divine agents. Okay? Their presence on the scene, just their very presence, the fact that the world had people like this in it, was evidence of God's role in human events. It can't be that there's a Jew with so much influence or so much potential influence that has to be part of a divine plan. Okay. And the same went for emancipation, right? He saw it as a kind of qualified good, mainly an opportunity to advance a divine plan. He wasn't interested in what, let's say, the Reform Jews were interested in, you know, equal rights and acculturation. He didn't care about that. He saw it as, you know, the potential end to Jewish oppression, which, again, it wasn't that either. But he saw it as a clarion call, as an opportunity to advance a divine plan and return to the land of our fathers. Okay, and he has in source number six, and again, like Alkali, he also was a Kabbalist, and he says, "Val yedei isarusa milatasa yavo isra'usa mila eila." There's this sense that human efforts start the process, and then God responds. If you do the work down below, God will respond from up above on high. And again, this sort of the pre-Herzl notion of you can't just wait around. This isn't just going to, you know, fall out of the sky one day. If you want to bring about, some positive change in the world, you have to do the work to bring it about yourself. It's going to happen through human agency. Hashem will help, but you have to start. Okay, and that's kind of the guiding principle or the guiding philosophy of this worldview espoused by Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer. Okay, so let me just pause there and ask you if there are any questions or comments, and then I want to share something about his legacy.
It seems to me that there's a striking difference between Alkali and Kalischer on the one hand, and Herzl on the other. Herzl's Zionism came out of a deep-rooted pessimism that basically we were oppressed and that it's going to get worse and worse and nothing, you know, because of the Dreyfus case. Whereas the other two seem to be motivated much more by optimism. It was a much more hopeful kind of a Zionism.
Yeah, it's a great point, and it's a great segue. Historians would characterize the Zionism that we're talking about with Alkali and Kalischer as religious Zionism or Messianic Zionism. It's proactive and it's sort of positive, affirmative. And political Zionism, which we'll talk about next week when we talk about Herzl, is reactive and responsive. And it says the current situation is untenable. You know, fill in the blank for whatever reason it is, the anti-Semitism and the Jewish question and the unsustainable nature of Jewish presence in European countries where we're unwelcome. And we have to do something about it, right? But again, it's a reaction rather than something proactive. And I actually want to just pick up on that point and amplify it. Herzl was, you know, like writ large, let's just say Herzl was successful. Alkali and Kalischer were unsuccessful. I'll talk a little bit about the sort of qualified success of Kalischer. But, you know, there's a reason why, you know, every third grader has heard of Herzl and they've never heard of Kalischer and Alkali. What did they actually accomplish, right? How much, you know, like how many Jews moved to Israel because of them? Not that many. Right? So part of the issue was the function of the timing. Right. Until the 1880s and then 1890s and the turn of the century, we get to Kishinev. So, you know, Jewish life is okay, right? There's not this urgency. There's not this sense of we can't live in the Pale of Settlement anymore. It's not working, right? In the 1830s, 1840s, 1850s, 1860s, it's working, right? So, you know, historians always look at immigration patterns to tell you about what the quality of life is like in a given place, not just historians. You look at it, you know, the data like in America, so the states people are moving to, the states people are moving from. It's a commentary on what life is like, right? If everyone's moving to California, I don't think they are, but if that would be the case, it would tell you there'd be something attractive about California. How many Jews are moving to Palestine in 1860? 1,000? 5,000? Right. Once you get to the 1880s, it becomes the tens of thousands. So what changed? Right. So principally what changed is the sense of urgency, the sense of safety, the sense of, you know, unsustainability of Jewish life in Eastern Europe specifically. Mm-hmm. So, you know, absent that sense of desperation, absent that sense of urgency, you know, the receptivity to the Alkalis and the Kalishers of the world were much more limited. Like, okay, I get the idea, but, you know, I'm not joining you in this backwater in Palestine under the Ottomans to settle an unsettleable land. Like, I can make it here in Kiev.
Yeah, so, you know, besides the technicality of the Dome of the Rock kind of being in the way, Was there any talk at the time about the fact that, hey, we have to wait for the Mashiach to come? Or like, was that sort of a sidebar or did that not even come up?
Yeah, it's a great question. So it's part of a really long and protracted discussion. I'll just give you a couple headlines. So one is, you know, to argue against Kalischer, one is there's no obligation to bring a korban if there's no temple. And if there's no Mashiach, there's no temple, and so you've put the cart before the horse. Even if you say there you could bring a korban before Mashiach comes, you have a whole host of problems, right? So where do you find a kohen? So the guy walks into the shul, says, "My name's Kohen, I'm a kohen." So does that qualify, or do you need to be a kohen miyuchas? You need to be able to trace your family lineage back to Aaron. Right, to be able to say, yeah, I'm 1,000% sure I'm a Kohen. Somebody's not a Kohen and they do the Avod in the Beis HaMikdash, that's a real problem. So where do you find someone who you can, you know, be guaranteed is a Kohen? Where does the Mizbeach go? There's a spot where the Mizbeach has to be. You know exactly where that is. How do you know it's not 2 feet to the left or 2 feet to the right? Right. So you're taking a big chance by building Mizbeach potentially on the wrong spot. Then you have another problem, which is even if you had the Mizbech and you had a Kohen, Kohen needs to be in a state of Tara, needs to be in a state of ritual purity. Who's to say that's even possible to obtain in the absence of a Paradum, in the absence of a red heifer? So there's a whole host of obstacles. It's not just like you can snap your finger. There's a reason. You know, the Ramban also lived in Jerusalem. He never thought of bringing a Korban, right? So, you know, there's a couple thousand years of Jewish history. Even though for the first 100 years after the temple, it seems like there may have been some interest or some actual korban bringing. But putting that aside, for a long, long time, right, no one had dreamed of this possibility. So it's not for no reason that the overwhelming majority of, you know, rabbinic authorities over the course of the past 2,000 years have not been keen on the reinstitution of
korbanos. So, right. So it really strikes me that Kalischer gained so much traction in general anyway, because like, I think today someone like that would be regarded as a quack and wouldn't even make it out of the starting gate.
Yes. Yeah. No. In some ways, that was the response, meaning I'll give you a few of the exceptions, but You know, most people were unmoved by his argument, including a lot of people that we, you know, think of today, like, you know, Rav Hirsch, the father of Torah, you know, Torah im Derech Etz, like, he wasn't interested in Zionism. So, you know, right on down the list, like, it wasn't, you know, it's so obvious to us in the religious Zionist community in the 21st century, but it wasn't obvious to almost anyone in this period, especially pre-Herzl. And next week, we'll talk about the reactions to Herzl. A lot of people thought he was a quack. Right? So in a lot of ways, this, you know, was kind of representative of what was to come one generation later. So before we run out of time, I put together a list. I came up with nine examples of Kalischer's influence on kind of the Jewish world, and I'll just share them very briefly. Okay, so number one, in 1839, Kalischer began a correspondence with Montefiore. Remember, I said that he viewed these Gedolim, you know, Montefiore and Crémieux and Rothschild, as agents in the divine plan. So he wrote to Montefiore, and eventually Montefiore did travel to Palestine. He didn't, you know, purchase Jerusalem, but he did purchase land there, and he supported colonization efforts and started the first Jewish orchard outside of Jaffa. So you really could say that, you know, he succeeded in making an impression on Montefiore. And as one scholar put it, this is a quote from Nachum Sokolow, he says, Montefiore's outspoken love for Zion was largely due to Kalischer's suggestion. Okay, number one. Number two, there's a man called Chaim Lurie, who was contemporaneous, basically, with Kalischer, also died in the 1870s. He was really responsible for forming the first society of its kind, which was called the Association for the Colonization of Palestine. He formed it in Frankfurt am Main in 1860. And this was like a pilot program. And again, we'll talk more about it next week. But these kinds of societies began to spring up very gradually in the coming decades all over Europe. And this was the first of its kind. Number three, there was a man called Karl Netter, who was really responsible for founding Mikveh Israel, the first agricultural school, the first agricultural society in Palestine. And it was really Kalischer's influence that precipitated the founding of that colony, of that school. Number four, the Malbim. When we learned about 19th century commentaries on the Torah, we learned about Meir Leibush, the Malbim. And we actually have a letter. Maybe I'll just pull it up because it's so fascinating. We have a letter that the Malbim wrote. It's undated. So there's a book called Shivat Zion. It's like a collection of letters that have to do with, Zionism in like the early years. And it has this this letter from the Malbim written to Tzvi Hirsch Kalischer. And he says, all this greeting, and I wish you well. And we'll just pick it up. He says in the fourth line, he says, Uvi kar hadavar, tvarav amitim v'kenim. Speaking about, speaking to Kalischer in the third person, he says, his ideas, your ideas are totally right. Piyeshli kama rayos mi pshuti haksuvim kfi pirushi. He says, according to my interpretation, I could support everything you've said, Rav Kalischer, based on the psukim, ki ha-geula titzmach la'at la'at. I agree with you that the redemption will come piecemeal, incrementally. Kishachar, nachon matzah holech v'or ad nachon hayom, right? Like a sunrise. It doesn't just happen in an instant. It takes time before the night turns to day. V'shetechila yityashev anashim ibnei Yisrael be'eretz Yisrael b'rishiyon malchei ha'aretz. Hayesharim b'chasidim v'yeh yeshuv eretz Yisrael kodem b'yas ha-mashiach. What you're saying is right, that based on the permission and the grants that we get from the important nobles of the world, we'll settle the land and then Mashiach will come. And he says, and just like the pasuk says, "Chmashakasuk b'ter shishayal pasuk b'terem tchila yelada." Umi ten v'yalech hatzo b'yadov shi'azman laze eis ratzon uke'ei sinene dush bi'ava rabba b'yaza. Avas Olam Vimirz Hashem Kesherut Lihazman Arich Divrei Yedidi Meir Leibush Malbim. You know, and that that moment should come Bimheir of Yamenu when we have the opportunity to return to the land of Palestine. Number five. This is an interesting one. There's a man called Moses Hess. You know his book, Rome and Jerusalem. Okay, written. I don't have the date in front of me. I want to say in the 1870s. Someone will pull out the exact date of publication. So who was Moses Hess? Moses Hess was raised as an Orthodox Jew. He lost his interest in religion and became interested in socialism and utopianism. And at some point, because of anti-Semitism, took a renewed interest in Judaism. And he started reading Kalischer. And he started corresponding with Kalischer. And Italian nationalism was the model for him too. He wrote, Rome and Jerusalem. And he quoted directly from Drishat Zion translations. I should have mentioned that Drishat Zion, a couple of years after it was written in Hebrew, was translated into German. And Hess, he could have read the original because I think he had a yeshiva background, so he could have read the original in Hebrew, but he quoted it in German for his readership because he wrote Rome and Jerusalem in German. It bore directly on his philosophy. He was like the forerunner of labor Zionism. And I don't know if we'll have time to get to it next week, but when, Herzl basically wrote all of his political and Zionist works, ignorant of the proto-Zionist literature that had come before him. So when he finally got around to Rome and Jerusalem, he says, oh my gosh, if I knew what Hess had written, it would have saved me the trouble of writing Der Judenstaat. So, fascinating, the kind of line to be drawn from Kalischer to Hess to Herzl. Number six, there was a man called Eliyahu Guttmacher. I have a quote for you. It's the end of your source sheet. He says, who was another basically Zionist activist in Europe. He says, it's an error to believe that everyone will live his life in the usual manner. And suddenly, one day, the gates of mercy will open, miracles will happen on heaven and earth, and all the prophecies will be fulfilled, and all will be called from their dwelling places. This is not so, I say, and I add, that settling the Holy Land, making a beginning, redeeming the sleeping lands from the Arabs, observing there the commandments that can be observed in our day, making the land bear fruit, purchasing land in Eretz Yisrael to settle the poor of our people there. This is an indispensable foundation stone for complete redemption. Right, the Kalischer could have written those words himself. Number seven, Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan Spector. Many of you have heard of Yeshiva University and its rabbinical school, of which I am a graduate, which was named for the most important and prominent Lithuanian posek of his generation, Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan Spector, who died, I believe, in 1896 when the Ritz was founded, I think in 1897. Correct me if I'm wrong about the dates. So it was named in honor of the Gadol Hador who had just passed away, Yitzchak Elchanan Spector. Okay. The undisputed leader of Lithuanian Jewry was so taken with Kalischer's proposal and ideas that he actually proposed that Jews all over Europe find a way to fund immigration to Europe. And what was the way to fund it? Everyone has a tenant, everyone has a landlord. Whatever the rental agreement, donate 1% of the lease to funding immigration to Israel. Number eight, Rabbi Israel Hildesheimer, we know is the founder of the Hildesheimer Rabbinical Seminary, where Rabbi Young received his smicha. Rabbi Israel Hildesheimer gave Kalischer his blessing, and I'll just conclude with number nine, Tzvi Pesach Frank, in Jerusalem. Republished Drishat Zion in 1919 after the Balfour Declaration. He republished it and redistributed it to encourage Aliyah. Right. So again, this is 50 years after Kalischer had dreamed up his plan of what a return to Zion would look like. Some Jews had in fact returned to Zion in the tens of thousands, especially in the 1880s and 90s, with the massive migration from Eastern Europe. But just to think, right, he didn't write his own book about why Jews should return to Israel. He just republished Drishat Zion because he thought right? This is the cat's meow. And if people just read Drishat Zion, they'll be convinced about why they should return to the land of their fathers and precipitate the messianic age. So I apologize that I have to run to Mincha, and I'm going to stop here.